Simply Authentic is the podcast where realtors and referral partners get the conversations they actually want to hear. I'm Crystal Forbes with Great American Title, a family-owned and operated title company with over 30 years serving the real estate community. We provide title and escrow services for both Missouri and Kansas with locations throughout Southwest Missouri. We focus on providing exceptional customer service and trustworthy, reliable title insurance coverage. Our relationships with other industry professionals are why we are able to make dreams come true one closing at a time. Great American Title is proud to sponsor the Simply Authentic podcast, bringing the most relevant, real, and sometimes challenging conversations that help all of us get better. Tune in, subscribe, and let's keep this industry moving forward together. Simply Authentic, recorded at the Gershman Mortgage Studios, available wherever you get your podcast.
Welcome to the Simply Authentic podcast with Angie and Tanya. We are real estate pros, entrepreneurs, leadership gurus, and community enthusiasts. Our passion is sharing our experiences to enrich the lives of others. We hope to inspire you to live authentically. Welcome back to the Simply Authentic podcast. I'm Angie Mullings.
And I'm Tanya Murfin. And today on the podcast, we have a special guest from Arves Bank. She is the Director of Mortgage Underwriting and Risk Management. Her name is Stephanie Elbin. Welcome, Stephanie.
Welcome.
Thank you. It's a title for someone that manages underwriting is really what that means.
Okay. Yeah, that's okay. A big title. Yeah. And Angie and I, being in real estate, understand that this is a very important job.
It is a very stressful job.
And yes.
As far as keeping one in the guardrails, everyone in the guardrails, yes, I think it is important. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it sounds like a lot, but it's really just making sure that we're following the rules that our investors require so that we can sell loans and they actually want to keep them, right? That's our goal.
Yeah. And that's a great explanation for somebody that has no idea what an underwriter would do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So just for our listeners out there who aren't as familiar with the process as we are, you go to the bank, you apply for your loan, you're going to have an appraisal done. So we're going to talk a little bit about appraisals. And then the final process is that underwriting process where someone is looking over the file to just check and recheck everything to make sure all the I's are dotted and T's are crossed. And that's a lot of what we're going to discuss today with Stephanie.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, every loan's different, right? So the underwriting team has to look at what loan is being requested. And then we, you know, take a look at the credit, income, assets, and then we make sure that how the loan is structured and the documentation that we have matches whatever the loan program requires. And yeah, so, you know, the borrower goes into a bank, they apply with a loan officer, that's the person that they talk to when they're requesting a mortgage loan. And then my team is the team behind the scenes that's really looking at everything and verifying everything and then reviewing it all to make sure that we meet all of the requirements and then saying, yes, is what we really want to hear, right? Yes, this meets all the requirements so we can close the loan. Or saying, you know, we need an extra pay stub or we need another year's tax returns or whatever documentation it is that we need, or maybe we need to restructure it a little bit different so that we can get it approved. But that's what my team is doing, is just validating the information that we're getting and making sure that we're meeting the investor requirements so that we can approve the loan.
Okay. And those investor requirements are different with different investors, correct?
Correct. So, you know, the big ones I think that everyone hears about is Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And they're both conventional loans. They have very similar requirements, but they're just different enough really to be annoying, to be honest. You know, they have different percentages on what they require for student loan payment calculations. But it's essentially the same loan. It's a conventional loan. Normally what people think of to be a 20% down loan program, but that is not the case. They do have higher LTV allowances, depending on borrower parameters, first-time home buyers, those kinds of things. But yeah, they're very similar, but they're different. And then you have, you know, FHA loans, maybe some people call them HUD loans, veteran loans, VA loans. But yes, they all have different requirements that could be very similar. But a lot of the times the documentation requirements can also be different. So somebody that's a W-2 employee, we may just need last year's W-2 and pay stub for conventional, but for FHA, we're going to need 2 years of W-2s and pay stub. So very similar, but just different enough that, you know, you really need to have that specialized team of underwriters that know the different loan programs, that are trained on the different loan programs. And even, you know, the government loans require underwriters to get designations in order to be able to be approved to underwrite those loans. So they go through training, but yeah, they can be different, you know, and then when you move into other investors that we can sell to for jumbo products, they're all going to have different requirements, and then also different allowances that, you know, you need to be familiar with when you're underwriting those loans.
That's a great explanation for our clients who maybe the first time they bought a house, they got an FHA loan and there were certain requirements. And then the next time around, maybe they got a conventional loan and there were different requirements. So that's a great explanation as to why it would be different one time over another.
Mm-hmm. Right. And you may get the same loan type that you got 4 years ago, but if you had a Fannie Mae loan 4 years ago and you're getting a Fannie Mae loan today, they change their requirements. You know, I get updates from Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, FHA, VA almost weekly of changes that they're making. So you're right. You may have gotten approved with this documentation that you supplied 4 years ago, but now we need this additional documentation that you didn't need before. So yes, they can change it. They can change them tomorrow. They can make them effective tomorrow. They normally give us a little bit of lead time. But yeah, they're making changes all the time to what they allow or what they require.
And I think that's just a really good point to make for, you know, a lot of times we're helping first-time home buyers and they want to bring mom and dad into the picture and get their advice and their direction. And that's fine. That's well and good. But we really have to explain sometimes that the process could be quite different than when mom and dad bought a house. And like you said, even if it was just 3 or 4 years ago, how often these things change. And for those of us who are training new agents, trying to explain what FHA is going to require when it comes to the appraisal. I mean, it's really difficult for me as a broker to train new agents on what to be aware of because that seems to change as well.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they do make changes occasionally. And you know, I was asked the other day, Freddie Mac recently changed their hourly income requirements. So previous to this change, which happened a couple of weeks ago, hourly income became probably the most complex income to calculate and document. You know, a few years ago, that was self-employment income. When you had a self-employed borrower, you know, it was like, oh, yikes, what tax returns do I need? Business and personal, what schedules do I need? You know, how do I calculate this? I'm not a CPA. You know, so that used to be the complex income. And then after COVID, Fannie and Freddie really highlighted hourly income and determined that it was variable income and put in some extra requirements for borrowers that earn variable income. And then 2 weeks ago, they made a change to it that really is going to allow more borrowers that are paid hourly to qualify easier than they were 60 days ago. So it was great news. But one of the questions I got was, well, why did they make this change again? Well, unfortunately, the investors and the agencies don't, you know, they don't tell us why they made the change usually. But, you know, I think it's because after COVID, there was such a big change in borrowers' work habits and their work schedules, right? So prior to that, people usually, when they were full-time, they worked 40 hours a week, right? That was the norm. Well, during COVID, for many reasons, borrowers changed their work schedule. They also, you know, probably had to go part-time with maybe their full-time job and then pick up another part-time job. So I think Fannie and Freddie really caught on to this. And I think also borrowers, for many reasons, chose to or were not able to work 40 hours a week. So they worked as much as they needed to pay the bills that they had. So I think with that change, Fannie and Freddie kind of, you know, added some additional requirements, wanted a bit of a history for variable income borrowers. But that really, you know, it restricted borrowers that maybe were in school for a specialized field like nursing. When someone's in school for nursing, they're usually in that school for multiple years. They may not be able to have a part-time job or even a full-time job during the time that they're in school, because I do think, you know, it's a big time, you know, it takes a lot of time for them to do that. When a person was getting out of nursing school, they would have to have a 12-month history of earning variable income in order to qualify for a loan, which seems really extreme, right? Because I think we all can agree that a nurse is going to work as much as often as they want. And they're probably not going to be without a job unless they just want to be without a job. They made those allowance. They changed some allowances for those types of borrowers a couple of weeks ago, which really will help more people qualify easier that are paid hourly, depending on certain things. But, you know, I think it was one of those things where they finally started seeing, okay, we're restricting all borrowers when maybe we should restrict only some borrowers, right? It makes sense to make a loan to someone that went to school to be in a specialized field, and then they got a job in that field. When it takes someone to go through training to do that, you know, if they've been on the job, we can show that they're working a required number of hours. It makes sense to do that. So I was glad to see the changes. But a lot of times when they make those changes, they just send us the information and they say, hey, we're making this change. They don't call lenders and say, hey, we're considering making this change and here's why. What are your thoughts on that? That never happens.
No.
You know, we're trying to figure out, you know, by reading the information they send us, okay, what exactly do they mean? When is this effective? When do we need to implement this? It's not usually a two-way conversation when they have changes like that. We're normally just implementing what they're telling us to do.
Yeah, makes sense. Stephanie, before we go into the next segment, we're going to take a pause here to hear a word from our sponsors.
Great leadership isn't about a title. It's about influence, impact, and the ability to navigate change with confidence. Many leaders struggle to communicate their vision, inspire their teams, and make strategic decisions that drive results. Without the right tools, performance and progress can stall. That's where iChem help. I'm Angie Mullings. With decades of experience, I can deliver a dynamic keynote and conduct hands-on workshops that equip leaders to lead authentically and create lasting impact. Ready to invest in a more engaged and high-performing team? Reach out today to schedule a consultation.
And we're back. We're with Stephanie Elbin. She is a master of underwriting and risk management at Arvest. And we're excited to hear from you today, Stephanie, because we as realtors and as brokers trying to do the best that we can by the time you get our file, best preparation for our clients and really laying out those expectations of what they're going to have to provide and why. Tell us, from your perspective, what are the most common issues you deal with in underwriting, and how can we as realtors be better?
I would say common issues is just information that we're not told up front, that we find out throughout the process. You know, one of the things that used to come up before they updated the 1003 was borrowers that worked for family. So when a borrower works for family, there are extra documentation that we need to get. It could affect the borrower's ability to qualify. Something else that comes up that really realtors can help with is when you know it's a unique property or when you know it's a manufactured home, let the lender know up front, right? The lender should also be, the loan officer should be looking at that when we're ordering the appraisal, because it does make a difference when we know up front this property is a manufactured home or this property is a log home. This property has, you know, a lot of acres with it. It helps us assign the appraisal better up front because we know our appraiser panel, we know you know, which appraisers are good with manufactured homes. We know which appraisers are really good with, you know, excessive amounts of property or acreage. Anything like that is great to know as soon as we can have that information when we're ordering the appraisal. The other thing that we see sometimes is addendums to contracts, counteroffers to contracts, getting all of those documents signed by all parties up front, and then getting that to your lender. I think a lot of times when those happen after the initial contract, everyone sends them to the title company, but the title company is not sending those to us when they're getting them. I think they're assuming that the realtor is also sending them to the loan officer. So it's super helpful when we can get all of those addendums up front or as soon as you guys have them. So we're not trying to deal with, you know, a seller paid credit change at closing or a repair addendum at closing, something like that. And then another thing to note is in contracts, and I think specifically Missouri does this, there's a section in the main contract that says, you know, you check the boxes for all of the addendums or the additional pieces of the contract, seller disclosure, lead-based paint disclosure. When any of those are checked, we need a copy of all of those. So anytime you get those, make sure that that makes it to your lender with the complete executed signed contract, so that we have all of that. But that's usually the thing. It's a real big issue when that happens, when it's at closing, and then we get it in our closing package. So the loan's already closed, and then we're trying to deal with those things after the loan is closed, which can be a really big issue. But at closing, that can really delay things when we're trying to make changes last minute, seller paid credits, changes in sales price, that kind of thing. Getting that as soon as you guys have them available, even though you've sent them to the title company, go ahead and send them to your loan officer too.
Mm-hmm. You know, Stephanie, you mentioned your appraisal panel. So you might explain to our listeners how you select your appraisers that go on your specific panel. What are you looking for? Is it getting harder to find them? Because we know that not a lot of people are getting into the appraisal industry. So we are dealing with a lack of appraisals in general. So can you talk specifically about that sort of process?
We have a committee that manages our appraiser panel. So, you know, there's a set of appraisers across the country. And it's not like this lender, you know, Arvest and any other lender has a different panel. We could have some different appraisers, but we probably have a lot of the same appraisers, including appraisal management companies. So there are management companies that manage their panel of appraisers, and sometimes we will order an appraisal through an appraisal management company. So Arvest is in Arkansas, Missouri, Kansas, and Oklahoma. So our panel appraisers are located in our footprint. If we have a loan outside of our footprint, we're going to use an AMC because we don't have an appraiser on our panel for, say, California. So we're going to use an appraisal management company that does have an appraiser on their panel for California. But we have a committee at Arvest that manages the appraisers. So when somebody wants to, you know, join our panel, there's some documents that they have to complete. And then that panel will look at test case appraisals. And they're really looking for the appraiser has knowledge of the areas that they're telling us that they're going to appraise. Because not every appraiser is going to appraise any property in the country. They're usually going to be certified by the state. But then they're going to probably have, you know, certain counties or maybe just a county that they're really specialized in. They know that area. So once they tell us what that area is, then they will do some appraisal test cases. And then the committee is going to look for, you know, quality in the appraisal, you know, what comps were used, does it support the value, the commentary that the appraiser puts in there describing the property. And then they're probably going to validate that with another appraisal from an appraiser on our panel, or maybe through an AMC, just to verify that, you know, the appraiser is familiar with the area. They're comping properties how we would like to have the properties comped, with the most similar comps that are available in curb appeal, proximity, size, site size, things like that. So there's a process to apply, and then there's a process once we determine we need an appraiser in that area. that they do some test case appraisals that are reviewed by the panel for quality.
So you kind of answered a little bit of this question right there, but as an underwriter, how much do you delve into that appraisal when it comes in on this file for Tanya? What are your, I guess it'd be interesting to know, what are your parameters? Like, how far do you go in requiring that appraisal to look a certain way or not?
You know, and it's going to be different based on where the property is and what is the property, right? Because
sure. Many
homes, for example, they're going to be more rural usually. So your comps are probably going to be farther away from the subject mm-hmm. than if you were doing an appraisal on a house in a subdivision on a lot and block. You should have mm-hmm. other properties comps available in that same neighborhood. That's not going to be the case with a rural property. Mm-hmm. So you're going to be really looking at what is the property type and then what is the loan type that we're looking at. And then, you know, like Fannie and Freddie Mac, for example, they have what is called collateral underwriter. And it's a system that lenders across the nation upload appraisals to every day. So as soon as we get an appraisal in our appraisal system, it's automatically uploaded to Fannie and Freddie Mac's system. And then they're doing this all day. So I think at one point they were getting like 30,000 appraisals a day. So they have a lot of data.
Gosh. Wow.
Not only the subject property, but all of the comps used. So they have a system that will say, okay, this is the subject property. This is the comps that were used in this appraisal. They can tell us if an appraiser says this comp is a condition of C4 or C3. If they used that same comp in a different appraisal, but they gave it a different condition rating, they're going to tell us that. If it gave it a different quality rating, it's going to tell us that. If it has a different square footage than what was previously reported, it's going to tell us that. But it also rates the appraisal. So using all of the data that they have from all of the comps, from all of the appraisals they're getting every day, it scores an appraisal on a scale from 1 to 5. 5 being there is a high risk of something, either under evaluation or over evaluation. Maybe it has some alerts that need to be addressed, like a different condition rating or site size or sale date or sales price amount. So we really are going to look closer at those because they have a high risk rating of, you know, maybe this isn't the right value for this property based on the comps given. A 1 would be the least, right? So anything 2.5 or under, we get rep and warrant relief. Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac is basically saying, we're good with this value and the comps used. What this system also does is it creates like a model appraisal. So it will tell us what other comps are available around the subject property. And we need to take a look at those and say, okay, it has 10 other comps in this system that could have been used, that Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac says could be used for an appraisal for this property. How do those comps compare to the comps that are used? And it will rank them, you know, however many, if there's 10, it will rank this comp is the number one comp. Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac thinks this is the best comp. And so it will go on down to if there's 10, 1 through 10. So you can see in that system, hey, the appraiser used 3 comps out of the 10, but he didn't use comps 1 through 4. Maybe the appraiser used 8, 9, and 10. We need to go and see, okay, what about comps 1 through 7? Why were those not used and should they be used? And so a lot of times we have to go back to appraisers and say, hey, can you tell us why you didn't use these comps? Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have these comps. They say they're available and could be good comps. Can you tell us why you didn't use them? Which is kind of tough because the appraisers don't have access and can't have access to that system. So because it's not every time that we need to go back and have them analyze that information, it just depends on, you know, what the score is and then what the other comps look like compared to the comps used. So that's kind of how, you know, we look at it from a Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac standpoint. But just in general, we're looking for comps that are similar to our property. So in a manufactured home, we need to have manufactured home comps. When you have a property on a lot and block in a subdivision, we're really looking for other comps that are similar in square footage. They have a similar lot size. They have a very similar curb appeal. And then they've sold pretty recently, right? 3 to 6 months is great, depending on the market. They need to be in the same subdivision. We also like to have them in competing subdivisions. When it's in, you know, we have some areas in some of our footprint where maybe houses don't sell as often, right? You have those subdivisions where people usually stay for a long time. So we may need to go to a competing subdivision, not the same subdivision, but one that has like homes in about the same price range. We have, you know, we also look at amenities. Swimming pools are a big thing. When a property has a swimming pool, we need to have some comps that have a swimming pool so we can determine what value a swimming pool brings to the subject property. And, you know, another thing to keep in mind is I think a lot of people think, if I build an $80,000 swimming pool, that's automatically going to increase my value $80,000. I wish
it right.
wasn't.
Right? Yeah.
What are other comps? What are they selling for with a swimming pool, right? So if a person paid $400,000 for their home, it didn't have a pool, they put in an $80,000 swimming pool, your value isn't going to be $480,000. The math just doesn't work like that. It may be we're looking at other comps in the neighborhood that have a swimming pool, and maybe they sold for $430,000, right? So you're not getting that dollar for dollar return. The same is true for outbuildings, upgrades in your home, you know, granite countertops versus, you know, tile countertops. You don't get dollar for dollar, you know, what you spend on those upgrades when you're looking at the value of your home.
What about things that we consider maintenance, like roofs and new HVAC systems? Are you guys giving any additional value for those things that are considered maintenance?
I mean, I wouldn't say we're giving it value, right? Because your house needs a roof and it needs to be a functional roof.
Yeah, right.
So anytime the roof needs to be replaced because of deferred maintenance, then that is usually, we're giving, you know, an appraiser is going to give that property a value and it's going to be a subject to value. So it's saying, hey, this house is worth $400,000, but it's subject to that roof being replaced because all of the comps appraiser has used in that appraisal has a functioning roof. So you're not going to get a value increase for that, but it is going to be a marketable property and then a property that can be financed, right?
Right.
Because that's the other thing, right? When there are deferred maintenance or there's repair items needed, the property has to be marketable. A property with a big hole in the roof is probably not that marketable. It also can't be financed, right? So
right.
Unfortunately, it's just maintenance or repairs that have to be done in order for the property to be sold, but also to be financed.
So on that subject, what about solar panels? Do they provide any value?
It depends. Don't you guys love how all of my answers are, it depends. when we're looking at solar panels, and this is probably something that realtors could help us with right in the beginning, because when you list a property or you show a property, you know then it has solar panels. So what a lender needs to know when solar panels are involved is who owns them. Are they leased? Did the borrowers purchase them? If they're purchased, do they own them free and clear? If they don't own them free and clear, are they financed? And then how are they financed? Because they're either going to be financed as personal property, which if it is financed as personal property, it, you know, it's not going to add any value. If it's financed with real estate attached to the property, then it can be included in the value. If they're leased, they can't be included in the value. And then we're also going to be looking for that the borrowers have access to another source of electricity, right? So if they're leased and somebody stops paying the lease and somebody comes and takes those solar panels, the property still needs electricity. So we really need to look at the credit report for the borrower, the title report for the property. If there's UCC filings on the solar panels, we need a copy of those so we can determine if they're attached to the real estate or they're not attached to the real estate. And then if they're leased, we will need a copy of the lease, because anytime there's a lease and the borrower has a monthly liability to pay for that personal property item, then we will have to include that in the DTI. We won't be able to include it in the value, but we do have to document, you know, that payment, the DTI, and then document payment history for that.
Great answer. And that gave a ton of information that I could ask 10 more questions about, but we won't get into that. But they are mysterious. Mm. And many times, if there is a $60,000 loan for said solar panels and they convey with the property, well, then so does that loan, or the seller has to pay off that loan at closing. Well, many times, if they could have paid that $60,000 to begin with out of pocket, they would have done so, right? So it really prevents properties from even being able to sell sometimes.
Right. And you want to make sure your buyer knows that upfront, you know, that
yes,
they sign a contract to get the information on the solar panels to determine what do we need to do with these. That way the borrower has full disclosure of, yeah, I want to buy this property, but it has solar panels. What do I need to do with those? How is that going to be looked at when I need to finance this property? So, yeah, unfortunately, it's a long answer of it depends. But I think if everyone can just focus on, okay, how are they financed and who's financing them? Are they leased? The other thing we've seen occasionally is a power purchase agreement where they have the solar panels and it offsets their utilities. But we still need a copy of all of those agreements that they have.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah. So Stephanie, Tanya and I saw you at an event that Arvest put on here in Springfield. And something that you guys talked about was interesting to me. You are, I know, and we all know that you are running those credit reports, you're checking on things the entire time. Obviously, one of the first things we tell our buyers is do not go out and make any major purchases, right? That's mistake 101 for buyers, is to go out and buy a new vehicle and then they don't qualify for the loan. But what you said that was interesting to me is that you're checking that even after the day of closing, because you still have to sell that loan. So can you talk to us about that process, about how many times that credit is being pulled, or you're looking at things throughout the application process, I guess?
So once the initial credit report is pulled, we start what is called undisclosed debt monitoring. So we're not re-pulling credit every time. It is a monitoring tool that tells us if the borrower inquires about another debt or gets a new trade line. So if someone opens a credit card, say at a furniture store, then we're going to get a notification that that customer applied for furniture store credit. We will not know if they were approved or denied, or if a trade line was actually opened, until the trade line reports. And then once a trade line reports, then we'll get that notification, and we have to go to the borrower for both of those. You know, we see you had a new credit inquiry. Can you tell us what this was for? Did you get new debt? But we're really monitoring that up until we sell the loan to Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac or, you know, whatever investor we're selling it to, because a lender is responsible for the loan until it's purchased by the investor. And after closing, it can take a couple of weeks, depending on volume and things like that. During COVID, it was taking a lot longer to get loans sold after we closed them. So there's a lot of exposure time for lenders that we're still responsible for if the borrower gets a new car. We see that a lot. Borrowers get a new house and then they immediately get a new car. Even if it's the day after closing, there's a 99% chance we've not sold that loan yet. So we're going to be responsible for including that debt in the borrower's DTI, and then hoping that they still qualify with an increased DTI. So yeah, we get notifications throughout the process. Anytime a borrower opens a new trade line or gets a new credit inquiry, we don't get notification if a borrower increases, you know, their credit card balance or things like that. But we do get notifications for new items that we will have to address throughout the process.
So let's say that borrower does buy a new vehicle the day after closing and it disrupts their debt to income. What is the repercussion of the bank? Do you have any repercussions? What happens to that loan then?
I mean, a lot of times, depending on if the borrower, if they can't qualify, then we can't sell the loan. So we'll reach out to the borrower, you know, hoping that if it's a new car, maybe they traded one in that they already had debt on. So maybe it's an offsetting debt, things like that. Mm-hmm. But you know, we're also going to look to see, did they already start this process and just didn't tell us, right? Because then we're going to have to address that with the borrower. But as far as the financial implications for the banks, we can't sell the loan, which, you know, we're making loans to sell them. That's the point. So,
right.
It's one of the things that lenders have to monitor. And then we're all the time battling, okay, what other hard stops can we put in the process? You know, we don't want to make processes too hard for borrowers to close and qualify. And, you know, another thing that we do right before closing is verify the borrower is still employed with who we have as their employer. Because that's another thing that we're still responsible for. Borrowers are still employed through when we close the loan. And it shocks me, and it shouldn't anymore because I've been doing this long enough, but it surprises me how often I see borrowers buy a house and then they go self-employed. They open a new business. And, you know, it's a problem for us because the borrower no longer qualifies and we've closed the loan. But, you know, honestly, I'm stressed for them. That just sounds very stressful to me to have.
It does.
And then you're also opening this new business, right? So yeah, there's a lot of things that we're trying to do at the last minute, right before closing, to avoid these issues. Unfortunately, there's only so much that we can do up until closing because we don't want to delay it. You know, we don't want waiting at the closing table because, you know, oh no, we need to wait to get this verification of employment back. So we try not to wait until the very last minute, but we wait as long as we possibly can and not inconvenience borrowers or the closing.
Yeah. Makes sense.
It has certainly changed my talk track with borrowers now and training agents that, you know, I used to say, I don't care what you do after you close the loan, you know, but now I'm going to say, maybe you need to wait a week or two, you know, just to make sure that there's not going to be any complications.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That would be great. Unfortunately, it's like trying to control the weather, right?
True.
Right.
Well, and I've had circumstances I can think of too. One where a car died, like literally the car died. They have to have transportation. Mm-hmm. They had to go out and get a new loan. And another job situation where he was highway patrol and he had a job lined up already in the town he was moving to. So that employment, although similar, was going to change very soon after they moved into that new house. Mm-hmm. So that might not be as big of an issue, but it changed nonetheless.
Well, and you know, that's been a change too, right? Between some of the agencies which makes sense. A borrower maybe changes a job. They don't, you know, quit their job and not have one. They just change jobs. And maybe their income's the same. A lot of times it's more when they're changing jobs. That makes sense. But Fannie and Freddie still have the option to require a lender to repurchase the loan, even if it's just an employment change, but they still qualify because we close the loan with a different employer than the borrower has when they purchase the loan. They can still require the lender to repurchase the loan.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. That's another good little tidbit there.
Yeah.
Years ago was not the case. You know, back in the good old days when we were doing NINA loans, those were fun. They were okay with it if a borrower changed employers or changed jobs. As long as their income was the same or higher and they still qualified, we just got that additional documentation and they accepted it. Sometimes they will accept it now and sometimes they won't. It's really just up to them if they take it or not, if they require the lender to repurchase.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Stephanie, as we get ready to wrap up here, I don't want to miss asking this question. So what are some things that you can't unsee? What are detriments to that file?
I mean, we can't unsee Once we see it, we've seen it. So there's yeah. not a category of, oh, if we see this, we can unsee it, it's okay.
Right.
You know, once we see it, and then we just need to deal with it. And I think, yeah. you know, a lot of times that can get people in trouble of, oh, I know about this thing, but I know if the underwriter sees it, it's going to be a problem. Let us see it. Because a right. lot of times we can figure out a way around it. Mm-hmm. And if we can't, you don't want to be the reason that we find out about it late in the process, as opposed to as soon as you know about it.
So true. Right.
Yeah. If we find out about it the day of closing, you know, there's not a caveat of, hey, if it's the day of closing and we find out this detrimental thing, that we're still going to let the loan close. We're never right. going to do that. Unfortunately, yeah. once we know about it and it's an issue regardless of timing. So it's always best to just let us know up front and then let us figure out what we can do to overcome whatever it may be. Because a lot of times, you know, I see this a lot where I'm like, man, if we just knew about this earlier, we could have dealt with this, you know,
yeah.
now we can deal with it. We're just going to have to pause closing until we can, you know, get the additional documentation or whatever it is, you know, that we're trying to overcome.
And what are some examples of things like that? Things that are big glitches that you should have known up front?
You know, the borrower working for family seems to be a big one, even though it's been okay. added to the application. That's a specific question. Do you work for family? We need to know that up front. Child support alimony payments, letting mm-hmm. us know those things up front. And I think a lot of times it's just borrowers don't think about it, right? You know, it's mm-mm. being automatically deducted from their pay stub. And maybe
right.
that up front, so we don't know about it and the borrower doesn't really know to tell us about it because they don't write a check for it every month. They just, mm-hmm. you know, used to not seeing it. Additional, so depending on the loan type, right, there are loan types like bond loans, RD loans, where we have to look at household income. Making sure yeah. that we know about everyone that lives in the household. And then any borrower or any person that lives in the household, when we're looking at household income, making sure that we are aware of all of their jobs. Because sometimes what happens is we get bank statements, and it's amazing what you can learn from bank statements, both the deposits and what's coming out of bank statements, right? So it may be another debt that's not on the credit report, but we can see a recurring payment being mm-hmm. taken out of bank statements. Or we yeah. see deposit, a reoccurring deposit. Okay, what is this from? Oh, the borrower does this side job. So just those kinds of things, letting us know of those depending on what the loan type is. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I don't think anybody just purposely doesn't tell us things. But when you're an sure. underwriter, you know what you're looking for. When you're a borrower mm-hmm. that's never underwritten a loan, you don't know that we're going to be looking at the deposits that are being put in your account. You don't know that we're going to look line by line at what's coming out of your bank statement for additional debts that may not be reported on the credit report. So you don't think to tell us those things.
Yeah.
But hopefully the loan officer is asking those questions. And then, you know, really having those in-depth conversations with the borrowers, depending on what loan program they're getting, just to make sure that we have all of that information as upfront as possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Makes total sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did we get all of our questions answered?
I think we did.
We could stay on here for a long time, Stephanie.
Yeah.
Angie and I could rapid fire questions at you all day.
That's what I get all
But day. We appreciate. Yeah, yeah. Well, exactly. Yeah. But we appreciate you being with us and teaching yeah. not only our realtors and who listen to this and people in our business, but I think the public will be interested to know all of these things as well, that nobody knows these answers mm-hmm. of what you guys are actually doing and underwriting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, you know, I think I've been asked before, how did you get into mortgage? Well, I have never met any person in mortgage that got in it on purpose. No one stumbles in it, and then you either love it or you hate it. And if you love it, you stay in it forever, but you never know why. You just do it. But it's not easy, right? And I think people that like to put puzzles together, like to make things fit together, make things make sense, really enjoy it. Because while I think sometimes we hear this loan is exactly the same as this loan, why didn't you require it on this loan and you're requiring it on this other loan? A lot of loans are not the same. You know, you're never going to have the same borrower buying the same property for the same sales price, right? So there's always going to be just enough that's different to make all of them interesting. So I think, you know, if you like that kind of thing, that's what keeps people in it. But it's definitely not stuff that's, I would say, is common knowledge. So it's not easy for people just getting in it to, you know, you're not going to learn this stuff in a week. And a lot of times you learn by mistakes, unfortunately.
Yeah,
absolutely. All of us.
Yeah.
In this job in general, right?
For sure. Well, thanks again, Stephanie. We really appreciate you. And we want to thank you for listening. We appreciate you so much. And we hope that you'll share this episode with anyone who's maybe thinking about buying a house or at least considering it in the future. Please share this episode.
Yeah, and make sure you follow and like us on social media and on YouTube. And we will, we want to thank Gershman Mortgage for recording with us today.
And also Great American Title as our premier sponsor.
That's right. Thank you, Stephanie. And thank you, Arvest, for letting us have your time today.
Yep. Thanks, all. We'll see you next time.
Bye-bye. Find today's full video by searching the Simply Authentic Podcast on YouTube. Hit subscribe, and there you will find full videos of every episode.